Interview with Rod Stewart.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Why don't you just begin by saying something about your personal involvement in the RL-10 program
right.
from the beginning, where you got into it?
Well, I was a project manager on the RL-10 engine, and let's see, I figure the date that I started on it was about 1963. Approximately, I'm not sure if that's exactly right. And I stayed on the program for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the engine was essentially under development at the time I took over the project. Previous project manager, by the way, is still employed here at Marshall. His name is William D. Brown, Bill Brown, head of the engine office. And he can probably tell you some things that maybe I can't. About the origin of it, but the RL-10 engine was used for the Saturn S4 stage. Six of those were used in the Saturn S4 stage, and two were used in the Centaur. The Centaur program preceded the Saturn, and because of that, it was an Air Force project to start with before it was turned over to NASA. And NASA took it over because NASA used the same engines for the S4 stage. Here's a picture of the S4 stage. There's mm-hmm. six engines in there. Mm-hmm. And in the two engine configuration for the Centaur, both engines gimbaled. In the six engine configuration for the S4, they also all gimbaled. The S4 is the predecessor to the S4B. Which is the third stage of the Saturn V.
Mm-hmm.
And the S4B is really an upgraded version of this S4, which had, instead of the six RL-10 engines, it had one J2 engine. The RL-10 engine has 15,000 pounds of thrust. The nominal duration in this application for the Saturn was 470 seconds, ran for 470 seconds. The engine weight was 295 pounds, and the propellants were liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. Contractor was Pratt & Whitney, and the let's say the Saturn S4 had six of them, and the Centaur had two. The engine was a turbopump fed. In fact, I guess it is a turbopump fed. The word was is not appropriate because it's still being built. And the thing that was unique about it.
What's its application now? Centaur?
And still being used for the Centaur, and it's being studied for other applications.
Mm-hmm.
Here's,
even though the engine's over 10 years old, it's still worth it.
Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Here's a brochure on the Centaur you might want to use if you want to.
Okay.
And it shows you the two engine configuration.
Mm-hmm. You want us to return this to you then?
You can have that.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saving it for somebody like you to come along.
Thank you.
Let's see, what else you might want to know about the engine before? It's a regeneratively cooled engine. That is mm-hmm. the fuel, the hydrogen is used in the stainless steel tubes here. To regeneratively cool the engine, the fuel enters in the manifold about halfway down the engine, goes down to the end of the bell shape into what they call a turnaround manifold, and then it comes up the adjacent set of tubes and back into the injector and is injected into the engine. I'm trying to find a flow diagram here for you. But it was the first application of hydrogen and oxygen in a rocket engine. And there were a lot of troubles in the beginning of the program, but later on, they were worked out. The troubles had to do with the cryogenics themselves, handling those, getting proper combustion, proper injector, and ignition.
Did you do much work at all on the injector as such?
Well, of course, I didn't myself. A lot of the engineers
mm-hmm.
did. But, most of the work on the injector was done later, in later mm-hmm. programs, as part of a throttleable program, throttleable engine program. Now, once we developed the engine, we determined that it could be throttled back and forth. And exact thrust level, I'm not sure, about 10% or so, mm-hmm. down to about 10% thrust and then up to 100% thrust. Well, during the throttling program, the various types of injectors were studied for allowing that throttleable mode.
Can you tell us something about the original S4 configuration was for four engines with Pratt & Whitney. They also had the contract for. Mm-hmm. It was called the
LR-117.
And then they went back to the LR-115.
I don't know much about that part of it. I think Bill Brown can help you better there because that decision was made after I got on the project. There was another application for it being considered. It was called the Saturn 1B Centaur, which the Centaur was going to be placed up on top of the 1B.
This was before the Apollo decision, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was before the Apollo decision, and that was not...
Well, no, if it was on the 1B, it was kind of after the Apollo decision, because the 1B came out of...
Exactly the time frame, I don't remember when that came in. Now, one of the unique things about the RL-10 engine is that the gears and the turbines and all were lubricated with hydrogen, with liquid hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a feat.
Could you give any details on that or comment further than that on it?
Well, yeah, the fact that... You see, mostly lubricants are like oil or something, mm-hmm. just for lubricants, mm-hmm. and they're based on reducing friction. Well, hydrogen doesn't reduce the friction at all. There's still just as much friction, but it cools off the bearings, cools the bearings and gears down below a point where they would wear. Mm-hmm. So, based on the cooling aspect, hydrogen is actually used as a lubricant. I think I have a blue diagram here somewhere. So the RL-10 was the first liquid hydrogen oxygen engine. Now it was different from the J-2. The J-2 didn't use what was called the regenerative cycle. In the RL-10 engine, the hydrogen passed through the chamber. And the heat created in the chamber caused the hydrogen to gasify, and then the hydrogen itself was used to turn the turbine. The fuel itself was used to turn the turbine, expanded fuel. And that was called the regenerative cycle. The J-2 engine did not use that cycle. They used
a gas generator,
right, yeah. Which turned the turbine, and then the turbine... Here's a picture of somebody hooked a couple of RL-10 engines on the wrong place, and the launch pad took off instead of the launch vehicle.
Okay. Now, that's something we hadn't uncovered yet. I'm glad you find that fact.
Yeah,
that's an actual
photograph.
Yeah. We'll do a chapter on that one.
That's an actual simulated photograph.
Was the RL-10 the first one to use the cryogenics as a bearing coolant?
Yeah, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. There may have been some jet engines or some other types of engines there. The basic problem about the RL-10 was the test facilities. We had to build facilities that would simulate a vacuum of space because the nozzle didn't flow full at sea level. That is. The jet would break away from the internal part of the nozzle and burn the nozzle when the engine's tested at sea level. In order to get this full flow, you had to fire it into a vacuum chamber called an ejector chamber. And there were several of these facilities. There was one here at Marshall. Here's a facility. It was here at Marshall Space Flight Center. And there also...
Is that still here?
I believe it's not still operating.
I mean,
and could operate. Still here, I guess it could operate.
Was this ever used for J2 testing?
No,
just it's not RL-10. Big enough.
Yeah, and then here's the one down in Florida. There are several of those down in Florida that had a vacuum test chamber facility. They had tanks and everything to test the engines.
Did you test the RL-10 up at Tullahoma too, in their vacuum stuff?
I don't think we
ever
tested
one.
We talked about
that,
it several times.
We
had to verify it, but I would say no.
I just haven't run across
it yet.
I'm not
sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember whether we did or not. Now, let's see. As far as historical significance, I think those are really the main points. The unique features of the engine, the fact that it can be modified for throttling, and it can be modified for running in what they call an idle mode, that is, without the pumps running, just open the valves up and the pressure in the tanks forces the fuel down into the engine, which runs at, then it runs at low thrust. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of producing what you might call self-ullaging, where mm-hmm. where you
do that first and then
yeah, if you have a stage orbiting in space and you want to start it up, just open the engine valves and ignite the propellants, the gaseous propellants that come through, and that produces enough thrust at the bottom of the propellants to bring the propellants down to the bottom of the tanks, and then it can go into the normal mode of operation. So it's a very flexible engine. It's a highly reliable engine. After the first troubles that were overcome, then it became one of the most reliable rocket engines we have today.
And those troubles you said were basically in what then?
Well, let's see now. As I recall, there were troubles in bearings.
And that was
bearing
taken care
trouble,
of by the cryo
by the hydrogen cooling.
Mm-hmm.
There were some difficulties in fabrication of the tubes, as I recall. The proper brazing and proper assembly techniques for the tubes. Mm-hmm. And there were several incidents. There was one of the S-4B itself, as I recall. This also, this was not caused by the engine, but one vehicle that had six engines in it, called an all-systems vehicle, had an incident. This was out of Sacramento, California, and the engines got, all six engines really got torn up. You see, they.
Mm.
But that was due to the vehicle itself, not the engines.
What caused that?
Let's see. I don't remember exactly. It was some valve that didn't open or just a little thing.
Was it Sacto?
Sacto, yeah. Sacramento. No, was it? Yeah, it was a Sacramento.
Sacto. Mm-hmm.
Sacramento. You can have those if you want to. That's, put those in your historical file, too.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some detail maybe about the fabrication of tubes, or the problem of holding the brazed tubes together? Was that the difficulty, or tubes that would hold up under the intense pressures and heat that were created?
I'm a little bit shaky on this point, unless I really did some thinking and about it. I'm not sure I could clearly define what the problem was there.
What were you on before you got into the RL-10?
I was on the M1 engine, which was a large hydrogen oxygen engine that was supposed to be 1.5 million pound thrust. And we started that program. It was supposed to be around $250 million program, $250 million program. And it was supposed to be used as an upper stage engine for the Nova vehicle, which was one of the earlier concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And for 9 months, I was the program manager on that. And because of the reduced funding, because of the decision not to go with the Nova, that was reduced to a technology program, and then the program was transferred to the Lewis Research Center and continued as a technology effort for some time, and then it was finally canceled.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great, a huge engine. It was about the size of the F1 engine.
Do you think we should have continued work on that kind of thing?
No. I think that was the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of new technology were you looking at in the M1?
Just size.
Just the scaling up.
Great big size was the only thing.
The J2, essentially,
yeah.
Which was still undergoing development.
Yeah, that's right. Now, at the same time of the M1 engine, Pratt & Whitney was working on our liquid hydrogen oxygen high pressure engine, which has a higher chamber pressure and therefore is a higher technology. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was the basis for their proposal on the shuttle engine, although we better not get into that because that's, that's controversial right there. But they did do some work on high pressure engines using hydrogen and oxygen.
Did you run into any difficulties with the Air Force in the RL-10 program in terms of getting into what they consider to be secret or confidential work?
Well, let me say first, I guess maybe for better clarification of this question, you might ask Bill Brown.
Okay.
But I can tell you that we had a lot of classified material because it was an Air Force program. But as I see it, there were no problems caused by that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of our NASA stuff was classified anyway at that time, and now it isn't, but there may have been some organizational problems of getting the Air Force information to NASA, you know, and all. I know there were problems there, but mm-hmm. normal to the transfer of any project from one organization to another. But the classification was there, but it wasn't a serious problem.
Did the most of the testing on the RL-10 take place in Florida with Pratt & Whitney's stands?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Did you have anything to do with the testing program down there?
Well, of course, as program manager, I had the whole program
yeah.
which involved the testing.
I mean, but it wasn't finished by 1963 when you got in there.
It was still going on. And in fact, we continued to test, as I say, other configurations, the throttleable configuration. Another configuration with the idle mode. There were some other proposals. You may remember the multi-mission module was a program that NASA at one time thought about instituting. That was going to have two RL-10 engines. It was also called an L-2 stage. Here's the artist's concept of that. And that never did bear fruit because it had no application.
What is that, kind of a lander type thing?
Yeah, it was to be a lander for payloads on the moon and mm-hmm. a lot of other possible things, a little bit like the space tug is considered now.
Mm-hmm. What about your relationships with Douglas during this time? Can you make some comments about problems or lack of problems when you got around to mating the engines
okay.
to the structure?
Yeah, I think the biggest coordination problem or effort in the whole RL-10 program was coordinating the configuration of the engine between Douglas and General Dynamics,
mm-hmm.
because Douglas had the S4 and General Dynamics had the Centaur,
mm-hmm.
and then Lewis Research Center was managing the Centaur. So every time we made a decision, we'd have to get everybody in the big room in the meeting, Douglas and Pratt and Whitney and Marshall and Lewis, and the Saturn office, the launch vehicle office, everybody concerned, and discuss it, and then make a change. Otherwise, we would make a change. And I guess that was one of the things that made it a fruitful program, that it was a common engine. That is, we retained commonality between the various applications. We didn't mm-hmm. go along with making two separate engines, one for Centaur and one for S4B.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the biggest coordination problem there.
Did you ever get the feeling that Convair wished that Douglas would have gone more their way in terms of stage design and construction?
No, maybe the other way around. Oh, you mean Douglas thought that Convair?
No, that
Convair thought.
No, the other way around
would be better, because General Dynamics continued to have problems with their thin tanks,
mm-hmm.
and the Douglas design was a heavier, beefier structure.
Mm-hmm.
So probably General Dynamics wished they would have gone the S4B route.
Mm-hmm.
S4.
Yeah.
In tank design. And structures
yeah,
design
yet? Well, I think so. Now
I talked to Kraft Ehrke, and he certainly
he doesn't agree with that, huh?
Didn't agree with that.
Okay.
They call the, some of the structures here built like bridges.
They are.
Heavy.
Yeah. You don't get as high a mass fraction with those these designs, but you get more reliability.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a choice there. But for a stage as big as the S-4B, the handling problems would have been tremendous. See, because these Atlas and Centaur, you probably know, have to be pressurized before you can lay them down.
Mm-hmm.
And if the pressure leaks out, the thing collapses. Yeah. So,
but the one that's over at the Space Museum is pressurized.
Is it?
That leaking.
Yeah.
Disappearing.
Yeah, and if you take one this big and try to use that philosophy, then you got to keep it pressurized all the time, and that's not practical for one that size.
Mm-hmm.
You have to not be so careful about how you handle it.
Well, one of the things that you constantly run into in the Saturn program is man rating.
Mm-hmm.
And the J2, of course, was designed as a man rated engine, so was the F1. But the RL-10 wasn't. And I guess I'm just vague about man rating. What difference does it make?
I don't know. I agree with your question, and I've asked it myself. What is man rating?
Yeah.
What's the difference? What do we do different? Just try to do things better. And actually, the RL-10 was done pretty well to start with, so I think it was man rated.
Mm-hmm.
It was built by a company that built aircraft engines, which are all man rated. And they didn't know what the difference was. They didn't know what it was. And you said man-rated because they were used to building aircraft engines that had to fly for hours and hours on aircraft, which were not only had one man or three men in them, but they had 50, 100 people in them. And so they didn't even know what the term man-rating meant.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew what the quality meant. And Pratt & Whitney was excellent in terms of their quality and their dependability of their engines. In fact, their little seal says Pratt & Whitney, it says dependability on it. They did an excellent job on the RL-10 engine, and as they do on their jet engines.
Realizing the difference between the RL-10 and the J-2, can you make any kind of general comparisons or comments about maybe which one is better or why? Or?
No. Let's see. I used to know some reasons, for example, why the J-2 was designed the way it was, and mainly it was because it was bigger. And let me see if I can think of some of them. The larger engines are not as susceptible to the regenerative cycle as the small engines are.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to do with the areas and the volumes, the areas available to heat the hydrogen, and the volumes of hydrogen that go through the engine. For smaller engines, the regenerative cycle is better. For bigger engines, the gas generator cycle is better. For example, we didn't try to use a regenerative cycle for the M1 engine. We went ahead to the gas generator and turbopump. The M1 was an overgrown J2, but later on, Rocketdyne tried to adopt this approach to the J2, and in fact they called it the J2S, I think. And I tried to sell that to NASA, but I don't think it's ever been developed now. I'm not sure about it.
It's like the simplified F1 that has a whole new, easier manufactured head to it.
Then. Yeah. The J2S, I think, was supposed to be simpler and easier to build, and it may have at least one version of it incorporated this regenerative cycle. And that's another reason why Pratt & Whitney went to the regenerative cycle for their high-pressure engine, because the high-pressure, high-thrust engine, even though it was higher in thrust, was smaller than an equivalent engine of low pressure. And it was much bigger than the RL-10 engine. So because of its small size, they were still able to better go to the regenerative cycle. So the basic design of the two was different, partly because of the size difference in the engines.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I really didn't know that before. Can you think of any other comments or differences between the two engines?
Well, I can't right now. I might be able to get you some backup data on it if I think about it a little bit. But That question was asked a lot during the time we were developing the engine. Why isn't the J2 and the RL10? I mean, why aren't they the same configuration? There were a lot of reasons behind that.
In 1963, when you were getting into this, did you still find that there were occasions when you would be inclined to pick up the telephone and call a counterpart at Pratt & Whitney directly and kind of bypass the normal lines of management?
Well,
how did you really get things done?
To me, that was the normal line of management.
Okay.
From project manager to project manager.
Yeah.
And I picked up the phone about 3 or 4 times a day and talked to their program manager directly, and there were no in-betweens because we were counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I hesitated to go the other route, actually, because the other route meant I had to talk to my boss, and then he had to talk to the president of Pratt & Whitney, and so on and so forth. So the counterpart-to-counterpart communication was really the best way to manage.
Is that still typical?
Yes, sir, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I guess what I was getting at is sometimes we heard that even the engineering drawings would be worked out over the telephone, and then the orders would go back to the shops, draw it this way.
Possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. When you look at your manufacturing line there, did you run into any difficulties in the program and getting the right kind of parts and keeping the manufacturing lines running at full capacity? Since this was the first hydrogen engine, and there were obviously going to be problems.
No. The biggest parts of the engine were built by Pratt & Whitney right in-house.
Mm-hmm.
They were all fairly new, newly designed. The turbo pump, the tubes, the technique for forming the tubes and assembling them, brazing them together and so forth was all done by Pratt & Whitney, at Pratt & Whitney, and only common parts to other programs were maybe some of the electronics.
What about Marshall? Did Marshall do tests here and found out maybe that there were certain changes they wished that the RL-10 would undergo?
As part of the idling and throttling program, I think yes, but as far as the basic development of the of the engine, it was already developed by the time that we took it over.
Mm-hmm.
We did some verification testing of the interface between the RL-10 engine and the S4 stage, testing the valves, valve sequencing, the flow rates, cavitation, and various things like that in matching the engine to the stage. But as far as the development of the engine itself, we did not participate in it other than through our technical monitoring, advice, consultation. We may have done a few material laboratory tests to verify the ways they build things and some component tests, but we essentially left the responsibility of the development of the engine in the hands of Pratt & Whitney.
Now, there's another question I had at the back of my mind. Now, all of a sudden, I've forgotten it. John? Do you have any questions to ask?
No, I've
here?
Done that same thing, Roger.
Okay.
About
and,
two things, and when we got onto the lawn, I forgot what I was after.
But I'd say, if I've had to make a general statement about the overall program, it was the world's first liquid hydrogen oxygen engine.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first multiple application engine that I was aware of for space, anyway. That was unique. It was a unique management problem because we had so many different interfaces to work with. And it proved the technology of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen for future applications.
Excuse me, John, I run down the question in the back of my mind here. We were under the impression that there were difficulties early in the program of getting large enough supplies of liquid hydrogen in particular for testing.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what they were specifically.
Did that come under your office, or was that logistics?
It did later in the program, of course, when I came in, but it was not really a terrible problem when I was on it. because our engine used less than the J2. The J2 was in operation, being developed at the same time. So the RL10 always seemed to be able to get hydrogen, and there was a hydrogen plant right there at the Pratt & Whitney plant right in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not too much of a problem. There were some plant breakdowns and incidents, which we had to get over the hump on, but I don't consider that a major program problem. So. Mm-hmm.
John?
That was it, Roger.
Okay. Good enough, yeah. Do you recall any humorous little events or stories in the thing? So often we get the reactions either just nothing but nuts and bolts, didn't learn any human things.
One thing which was rather interesting was the fact that in one of the engines, development engines, which shows the real ruggedness of the engine and also the features and advantages of hydrogen cooling, one of the bearings burned out. And if you can see a picture of the pump, you see the pump is just an impeller inside a housing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bearing burned out and the impeller started rubbing against the housing. It just fell down and rubbed against the housing. Now, if that had happened in an ambient environment, say air or even with oil in it, it would have burned up in just a couple seconds because the heat would have been tremendous. But this thing ran for 2 minutes in that condition before it was even discovered that there was anything wrong. And of course, it didn't burn up or anything. And that was due mainly to the hydrogen cooling. The fact that there was no bearing at all supporting the impeller, and the impeller was running right on the housing. It's like a brake running on a brake drum for 2 whole minutes and no incident. That's an interesting anecdote that tells how good the hydrogen cooling was.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see if I can think of any others.